Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Convention continues its not unwelcome reign with two guests today. Stephen Simon will talk about Israel and the Arab states' relations with it, and Jennifer Berkshire will tell us about the right wing's latest educational ploys. Before that, a word about a guest from last June, the New Orleans-based artist Marcus Brown. I interviewed him about an augmented reality sculpture exhibit he just mounted on the site of New York City's main slave market at the corner of Wall and Water Streets. The exhibit was part of a series he's been working on around the country called Slavery Trails, about an awful part of American history that a lot of people would rather forget. The history of slavery in New York City is deep, ugly, and largely forgotten, at least in the public culture. Marcus is trying to change that. He was in New York on Wednesday to observe Juneteenth at the site of his Wall Street installation. He was also in town to mark the opening of two satellite installations, one at North Fifth Park and Pier in Brooklyn, and the other at Queensbridge Park in Queens. For more, visit his website at arslaverytrails.com. That's arslaverytrails.com. I contacted Stephen Simon, a research fellow at the Quincy Institute, because I was curious about some of the Arab states' relations with Israel, especially during the Gaza War. They seem to have reached some sort of accommodation, maybe even an alliance, and I wanted to know more. But we first got to talking about politics in the war-making state, Israel, and the very gloomy prospects for a quick end to its pummeling of Gaza. Aside from his work at Quincy, Stephen Simon is just coming off a visiting professorship at the University of Washington. In the past, he served on the National Security Council under both Clinton and Obama. He is, in other words, a more establishment source than your typical Behind the News guest, but we seek knowledge from everywhere. We open with a discussion of Benny Gantz's resignation from Netanyahu's war cabinet. Gantz was viewed by some inside and outside Israel as a moderate alternative to the extremism of Benjamin Netanyahu, but as you'll hear, that reputation was unearned. Stephen Simon. You had a piece in Responsible Statecraft about 10 days ago or so, commenting on Gantz's departure from the war cabinet. What, if anything, does that mean?
I don't think it means anything very much. The war cabinet is not the cabinet. The war cabinet was sort of an ad hoc group that was pulled together and billed as the war cabinet, but it's not the government. His departure doesn't change anything politically or in terms of government structure or in a way that would precipitate early elections or anything like that. It serves Gantz's interest to some extent because it enables him to put some distance between himself and Netanyahu. But no, in terms of any immediate impact on either the Gaza war or Israeli domestic politics, I don't see very much.
He was opposed to a two-state solution and doesn't really have much of a plan himself for the day after. He really wasn't contributing that much at all, was he?
No, not really. You know, there was, of course, a call to arms after October 7th and a premium placed on national unity in the face of the challenge and the scope of the disaster that the Israelis experienced on October 7th. And those things contributed to Gantz's decision, along with Gadi Eisenkot, another former chief of staff of the IDF, to join in the war cabinet. It's not really as though Gantz's approach to the war was materially different to Netanyahu's. Perhaps as of late, they had differed, or as Gantz had framed it, Netanyahu had no plan for the day after. And it was important, obviously, to have a plan for the day after, if no other reason than the Biden administration was demanding that the Israelis come up with one, at least one that was plausible. But it's not as though Gantz's vision, for lack of a better word, was any more plausible than anything that Netanyahu himself had put forward.
The Biden administration's preferences, they don't really seem very intent on enforcing them. They're not going to withhold any money or bombs. So what attention should Israel pay, or Netanyahu in particular, pay to the U.S. administration's preferences?
Well, Netanyahu, in political terms, is in effect running against Biden. To the extent that he's doing so, it's important for him to be seen as defying Biden rather than complying with Biden's preferences. You know, I don't think that Netanyahu has any strong interest in this. I think for Netanyahu, Biden is a kind of a speed bump on the way to a Trump presidency, which I think Netanyahu probably accurately foresees as one that's that will be much friendlier to Israel's maximal objectives. Your basic point of the thrust of your question is apt. I mean, Netanyahu doesn't have a whole lot of incentive to go along with what Biden wants. I mean, we'll see what happens when Netanyahu comes to the United States to address a joint session of Congress and what he says then. I expect he'll address his remarks primarily to Republicans in Congress. He'll probably ignore what the Democrats are interested in seeing, or certainly the progressive caucus in both houses. You know, and right after that, the Knesset goes into recess. So Netanyahu is in his, you know, will really be in his element, completely unconstrained. And going into that period, that interim between the time the Knesset goes out of session and the time it returns just before the U.S. election, he'll be free to shape the narrative as well as events on the ground as he wishes.
As for having a plan for the day after, is there anybody in Israeli politics who does, or even have an idea of how to get to the point where there even is an issue the day after, meaning after the war ends? It seems like there's really no interest in ending this until what? Until Gaza is completely destroyed?
I take your point. You know, I struggle to imagine myself what a day after plan would look like. Immediately after October 7th, I did a— it's always in bad taste to refer to your own writings, I guess, but—
That's okay. Don't worry about that.
Indulge me. You know, I did a piece in Foreign Affairs where I said, okay, the key thing now is to begin working on the day after, right now. Not a day can be lost. And I outlined a couple of options for a day after plan that would, at least in theory, stabilize the situation and minimize suffering. That's all, of course, you know, overtaken by events at this point. But it was clear to many, not just to me, but to many people that, okay, this thing had just happened, this terrible thing on October 7th. The Israelis were going to do something military, and a hard rain was going to fall. But planning for the day after had to begin, because the lead time to organizing a plan that can be implemented was going to be long. I mean, it wasn't going to happen overnight. That was obviously a very long time ago. And now there's just been a lot of blood under the bridge. And how the situation can be resolved in a way that fosters, you know, stability and reconstruction is, in a sense, almost an unanswerable question at this point. Because so much damage has been done. I mean, there are so many facts on the ground that have been created. And you hear silence from most every quarter on this score, because nobody really knows what to say.
Well, I don't think we even really have a full understanding of the extent of the damage, given the limitations on journalists and foreign observers there.
I think we can safely say that tens of thousands of people have been killed.
Yes, we can safely say that. Well, probably much more.
You know, in the days of the Syrian civil war, I was kind of involved in government efforts to calculate the human cost of the war as it was taking place, in part as an effort to spot large-scale atrocities before they actually took place. And that effort underscored for me, anyway, how hard it is to know how many people are being killed. But suffice to say, there are huge numbers have been killed or are injured in a large part of the infrastructure in Gaza. The built environment has been either destroyed or damaged. And the bill grows every day. The fact that the Israelis have been unconstrained and have pursued a military strategy that entailed severe damage to Gaza's infrastructure virtually guarantees that the task will be unimaginably large when the shooting finally stops and there's some arrangement involving the Israelis, obviously, that would foster or trigger a reconstruction process.
As for Netanyahu, you pointed out in that article, you just did again, that he has to hold on for a little over another month, then the Knesset goes on recess. They won't be back until just before our election, which is quite possibly going to produce a Trump presidency. So is it BB for as far as the eye can see?
I don't think that elections are required for almost another 3 years. In other words, that's how long the current Knesset has to remain. In theory, he could be around for that long. I don't see an opposition to Netanyahu really evolving in Israel at this point, at least not one that has any oomph. And Netanyahu's incentive to stay in office, in part because of his legal problems in the Jerusalem District Court. That's a pretty powerful incentive. You know, the idea of staying out of jail is pretty powerful incentive to stay in office. So he'll do anything necessary. Now, whether he, as some people allege, is deliberately prolonging the war in Gaza to increase his chance of staying in office longer and hamstringing whatever opposition might exist, I don't know. It's probably a factor in his thinking. I don't know if it constitutes the entirety of his political or strategic calculations. But I would expect that he intends to stay as long as he can, as long as this Knesset is in session. And as long as the opposition is essentially in disarray, he stands a good chance of doing so, especially in the context of a Trump presidency, where he can claim the mantle of being the Israeli who has not only firmly responded to Iran and the Palestinians, but at the same time been an effective, even superlative custodian of the most important relationship Israel has, and that's with the United States.
What do you see as the likelihood of a full-blown war with Hezbollah? Before we started recording, I got a bulletin on my phone saying that Israel is making very hawkish noises, gesturing towards Hezbollah. That would do serious damage to Israel and to Lebanon. What's the likelihood of this breaking out?
I don't know. Okay, this is how I think about it anyway, in the absence of an answer to your question. First, if you're an Israeli, especially on the military side, you probably think this is not a bad time to do it, in part because Israel could have the advantage of tactical surprise. Okay, that's different to strategic surprise. They won't have that because Lebanese Hezbollah and many Lebanese probably, you know, anticipate at least the possibility of an Israeli attack. And they understand that the strategic circumstances for such an attack exist, but they won't know exactly when and how it will attack. And that confers on Israel the advantage of tactical surprise. And that advantage is enhanced in a couple of ways. First of all, the bulk of Israeli armor now is up north. What they need to do to invade Lebanon, all that stuff is at its jumping off point. Secondly, there's a lot of shooting going on back and forth, and that provides cover for a surprise attack because the Lebanese Hezbollah doesn't necessarily know whether an exchange of fire is the opening shot in an Israeli invasion or it's just a continuation of these tit-for-tat attacks. The Israelis, you know, probably also believe that given a combination of robust air defenses on the one hand and the advantage of a surprise attack, particularly by air, on the other, could sufficiently damage Hezbollah's ability to launch a lot of missiles at Israel and in the process damage Israeli infrastructure and kill a lot of Israelis. They might think that. If you take those factors sort of in combination and add to them that Israel, since the war in 2006 between, you know, Israel and Hezbollah, that Israel has been practicing and doing everything it can to develop the doctrine and capabilities to fight Hezbollah in Lebanon, you might find yourself looking at a lot of Israelis who are thinking, you know, something, we can do this. We can do it. That's a kind of a dangerous situation, clearly. I mean, nobody starts a war thinking that they're going to lose it, but plenty of people start wars mistakenly believing that they're going to win it. And Israel might not be an exception to that rule now. So I wouldn't rule it out.
I'm speaking with Stephen Simon, a fellow at the Quincy Institute. What about the Arab states' attitudes towards Israel? The older among us remember when it was or seemed to be uniformly hostile. Is that no longer true?
Arab youth, and it's, you know, talking about Arab youth is in itself, you know, a bit problematic, you know, from an analytical perspective, because, you know, you got all kinds of Arab youths in many different countries and, you know, at different removes from Israel. But I mean, at some level, they're not going to be all that different from youth in other countries, let's say even in the United States, where there's serious unhappiness with what the Israelis are doing in Gaza, how the Israelis are prosecuting their war. So I think that, you know, there was a lot of similar unhappiness in Arab states, particularly in the Gulf. We know in Iraq that there's a lot of unhappiness about this. And in Egypt, so the two other major Arab states outside of the Gulf, we know that there's a lot of unhappiness on the street about what the Israelis are doing, and that unhappiness exercises a certain pressure on the governments in both Iraq and Egypt. In the Gulf, I'm pretty sure that there's a kind of a similar unhappiness there too, although, in the Gulf, the attitude towards Palestinians and Palestinian woes is more, complicated, I guess. I don't know where things lie on balance, and I'm sorry to be so weaselly, on this score, but I have so much, I bear so much skepticism toward polling in Arab states that I'm skeptical about the question as a whole. And I think, certainly if you're talking about the Gulf states, the leaders there have a lot of leeway in how they want to deal with Israel, how close they want to get, whether and how they want to distance themselves when it seems necessary to do so. I mean, the fact that there's no elections in these states doesn't mean that public opinion doesn't matter. Leaders pay attention to it, but they're not, I would say, overly constrained by it.
What about Saudi Arabia? There's all this talk about how they're really crucial to any kind of peace deal. How do they figure in it?
The Saudis are still pretty interested, in pursuing the mutual defense treaty that has been discussed by the United States pretty openly, and I think is preparing to bring to the Senate in a Biden second term. I don't think it'll go up before then, but I suppose it could.
Now, that would require us to go to war on behalf of Saudi Arabia if they're attacked, right?
Well, if you read the fine print, none of these treaties require either party to do, anything.
So was it just symbolic or what?
The devil is in the details. What's required in these things, and the United States is looking at the U.S.-Korea and U.S.-Japan treaties that were finalized in the 50s and 60s, defense treaties, and also, Article 5 in the NATO treaty, Treaty of Washington. What's required is that in a contingency involving aggression, the parties to the treaty are required to consult on ways to deal with the situation. But it's up to the individual parties whether or not they want to get involved militarily, as a combatant. There are a lot of other ways you can support, an alliance partner without actually introducing troops, on their behalf and so forth. I mean, in NATO, people generally think in terms of, well, everybody's going to get involved, on the ground, and that might be the case, but it not necessarily. And I think that's certainly the way in which people are thinking about the Saudi treaty. That's number one. Number two, I think that the Saudi treaty is going to be framed very specifically with respect to Iran. It won't single out Iran as the only potential adversary of both countries and as the only inspiration for a mutual defense treaty, but that will be the country that most people have in mind as a potential aggressor. The treaty will probably stipulate that it applies only to sovereign states that might be aggressors, but not sub-state actors, which would, say, rule out a U.S. obligation to come to the assistance of the Saudis if the Saudis were attacked by Houthis, for example. And certainly it won't entail any U.S. obligation to assist the Saudis in dealing with internal enemies. So I don't think that, the United States will find itself necessarily trapped in a war at a time and place not of its choosing, but because of Saudi action. But it's certainly much more likely than it would be in the absence of such a treaty, because the United States does take these treaty arrangements seriously. No one knows how seriously the Saudis will take it because they don't have a track record in this regard, but the United States has quite an extensive track record. So, people understand that, for the United States, these arrangements are regarded as solemn obligations and, in fact, become U.S. domestic law. That's part of the process in the United States.
And Qatar plays a large role in these peace negotiations or whatever they actually are. Why and what kind of role are they playing exactly?
Well, Qatar is a state that really likes the Muslim Brotherhood. And for a long time, I think that the ruling family believed that the wave of the future in the Middle East was going to be led by or spearheaded by the Muslim Brotherhood. not as a military matter or some kind of war or something, but just this was the wave of the future. This was the direction in which societies were going, and it was not a bad direction for governments to go. So for governments to be dominated by the Muslim Brotherhood was generally regarded as probably a good thing by the Qataris. The organization that we know as Hamas had its origins in the Muslim Brotherhood, and it was a natural place for the external wing of Hamas to find shelter, to find a home and an operating base, you know, which the Qataris were happy to offer because of their general view of the brothers and organizations that were inspired by or created by people affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood. So that's the general picture. Secondly, the Qataris have a unique position in that they entertain all those attitudes that I just enumerated, but they're also a close military partner of the United States. And the United States has its regional air operations center in Qatar. It's got a very large air base in Qatar. So Qatar is pretty important to the United States, and the bilateral relationship is pretty strong, despite this sort of strange disjuncture in views about the best sort of governance for Arab countries. This gives the Qataris a kind of a strong position, a unique position as a mediator, because they're close to the United States on the one hand, but they're close to Hamas on the other. And the Qataris have also dealt in the past on a number of occasions relating to conflicts in Qatar with the Israelis. So there's long been a channel to the Israeli government as well. So when you put all this together, what you get is sort of a natural mediator for the kind of crisis that's still ongoing.
Now, finally, the prospects for a ceasefire in Gaza look quite dim, much less a long-term settlement. Right now, escalation seems a more likely option than ending the war on Gaza. What do you think?
I'm very skeptical that there'll be a ceasefire. It's in the interest of Hamas and the interest of the current Israeli government to keep this war going as long as necessary. And it's still necessary in their respective views. Neither leader, Yahya Sinwar or Benjamin Netanyahu, can afford to sign up to a ceasefire that seems to leave the other side holding the whip hand. Because it just raises the question, well, what was all the bloodshed about? And neither Netanyahu nor Sinwar are willing to sign up to that. But most conceivable ceasefire agreements, either one that, leaves Israel with the prerogative of resuming the war after the ceasefire and repatriation of hostages, or which leaves Hamas somehow in charge of Gaza, it's just not in the cards. So you've got the two main players, Hamas and Israel, holding out for an ending that would work best for their respective leaderships, and therefore operating on a very slow clock. And then you have Biden, whose clock is more like an egg timer. He needs to get this problem solved sooner rather than later because, he's looking at a Democratic convention in August, which he doesn't want to see marred by protests. But protests there will be if the war is still going on in August, as could happen. So he's pushing hard for something to end this thing, or at least give it a convincing pause and long-lasting pause as soon as possible. He also really wants this Saudi deal, and that's going to become much more feasible to put in place once the fighting in Gaza is over. And he wants to do this because, it's about China. And this administration is posturing for a confrontation with China that it's not looking for, it's not seeking, but in their view could happen. So best to get one's ducks in a row. And that means putting some distance or enforcing some distance between the Saudis and the Chinese. And the Chinese presently get a good part of their oil from Saudi Arabia. So that's a big strategic factor that's weighing heavily on the administration. they want to push this thing through. But again, they can't do it, I don't think, while the fighting continues in Gaza. So all in all, I think my short answer to your question is, nah, a ceasefire isn't all that likely.
That was Stephen Simon, a fellow at the Quincy Institute. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Some of A State of Peace in a Typically Pacific track by Noor Jabber from 2018, her normal fare is energetic techno. Originally from Beirut, she now lives and works in Berlin. Schools have been sites of political conflict since forever, though the details may change over time. Most recently, the book-banning impulses of the right have become all too familiar, but less familiar, but no less persistent, is the sinister agenda of privatizing the public schools through mechanisms like vouchers, which use public funds to pay tuition at private schools. And most of those private schools have little in common with Groton or Sidwell Friends. They're more likely to be reactionary religious academies. And the public schools themselves are now far from insulated against religious incursion. See, for example, Louisiana's new requirement that the Ten Commandments be displayed in every classroom. Here with more is a frequent Behind the News guest, Jennifer Berkshire, co-author along with Jack Schneider of The Education Wars, a citizen's guide and defense manual from the New Press. They also do a podcast on education topics, Have You Heard? Jennifer Berkshire. Right at the beginning of the book, you tell this tale of a North Carolina voucher school that doesn't require college degrees from its teachers, but proof of the ability to speak in tongues. that's a remarkable detail. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so I thought that this was just incredible. And there's a North Carolina teacher who has been doing just an incredible job documenting this. And so he goes through and he just looks at schools that are getting voucher money through the state. Because basically now North Carolina has set up a vast unregulated system. So you have to hold professional certification to teach in a traditional North Carolina public school. But that's not true at all for the vast majority of private schools in North Carolina, which are overwhelmingly religious. They're not just mainline Catholic schools. They're evangelical schools that have very elaborate rules about who can and can't attend, right? So not only can you not be an LGBTQ student, you can't have gay family members.
Family members.
Exactly. Yes, it's very expansive. And the state
because
now...
Because it's like a communicable disease.
Pretty much. And so it gives you a sense of the force that these kinds of schools can have on really putting a brake on any kind of social change. And that particular example of the wanting proof that teachers could speak in tongues, it...
That seems easy to counterfeit.
It does seem easy to counterfeit, and then it's right there in the online handbook of the school. Oh, you mean it's easy to counterfeit? You could pretend to speak tongues. I suppose that that's true. I'm not sure what the percentage of people would be that would be that interested in teaching like in a school like this that you would actually pretend.
It is a barrier to entry, but that's just remarkable. I'm jumping a little ahead of myself here, but what stage are the pioneers of this voucher movement? Like, who's big in vouchers now?
Over the last 2 years, we have seen just this tide of states enacting sweeping voucher programs. They're universal voucher programs, which was really kind of the original Milton Friedman dream. Any pretense that these are programs that are aimed at helping poor kids or minority kids or kids with special needs, we're done with that now. Now they are universal programs, and the strongest demand is among wealthy parents who already sent their kids to private, usually religious schools. So the state to really pay attention to is Arizona. It's leading the pack in that it's had one of these programs for the longer. It's blowing up the Arizona budget. Arizona is currently running something
like... That's an interesting point. Now, these things are supposed to save money, but they don't, right?
So that is just utterly false. They might save money if you had kids leaving public schools in order to take a voucher that was worth less than what the state was spending to educate kids in the public system. But that's not who's using these vouchers. They're going overwhelmingly to affluent parents whose kids already attended private religious schools. And so that means these are enormous new expenses for the state.
Whatever happened to charter schools? I mean, they were the big thing some years ago. You don't hear so much about them anymore. Is it all about the vouchers now?
Absolutely, it's all about the vouchers. So the Republicans have really kind of lost interest in charter schools. And I think what you're...
Also, it used to be a big liberal Wall Street Democrat thing, too.
Absolutely. So the bipartisan coalition that was so enthusiastic about charters has completely fallen apart.
Well, they did very badly at the polls, right?
Well, it really depends on where you are. There was way more public support for charter schools than there ever has been for vouchers. And so it's really key that in these states that are enacting these big programs, nobody gets to vote on them. Vouchers never get put up for a vote because when they do, they get voted down overwhelmingly. The record of charters is more mixed. But suddenly, you know, charters find themselves without natural allies. Democrats had cooled on them because the school choice movement has come to be seen as more and more right wing. Republicans have lost interest in charter schools because they want vouchers. And in states that have a lot of students attending charter schools, those schools are going to be really hard hit by vouchers. So I'll give you an example. You know about New Orleans, which is our first all charter school district, beloved by Democrats like Arnie Duncan. Well, Louisiana just enacted an enormous school voucher program. And like that's who's going to be leaving these schools.
So the charters are too public.
Absolutely. We almost saw a case make it all the way to the Supreme Court that would redefine charter schools as private. The Supreme Court didn't hear that case, but I think you'll start to see red states in particular enacting policies that basically say that charters are not government entities and therefore constitutional protections don't apply.
Schools have been hotbeds of political conflict forever, ever since we've had public schools. What's different about it this time?
It's absolutely true that we are always fighting about schools. And I actually think that it's not so much what's different this time. It's that we're now going back to a much older debate. So you probably noticed that a lot of the same schools that are enacting school vouchers also rolled back protections for child workers. They made it easier for you to be a child laborer in all kinds of dangerous...
And that was done in the name of parental rights, right?
That was done in the name of parental rights. And so I got really interested in this because that was really our very first parents' rights crusade in this country. That there was
this is the 20s?
Yes, this is the 20s. That industry groups organized what was our first AstroTurf campaign. Groups with names like Parents and Farmers Standing Together Against Government Overreach. And the idea was that, you know, if you kept little Doug from working on the family alfalfa farm, you were overreaching, undercutting his parents' parental rights. So this was a big deal at the time. So I was fascinated. So I went back and I started reading about the debate because this was really the case for making public education compulsory. It was really about ending child labor. And when you go back and you read who was in favor of keeping child labor, it's not sugarcoated at all. They didn't believe that people were equal. They thought that some kids were meant to go into the mines or the factories, and that having something like public education disrupted the natural hierarchy. You actually hear a lot more of that kind of reasoning coming back to the fore. Because otherwise, it's sort of like, what possible justification can there be for suddenly shifting massive amounts of state resources away from the majority of kids in your state towards the families that already have the most, right? You have a particular view of the world, and I'm guessing it's quite a hierarchical one.
Then if we go back to the 1950s, there was a privatization movement. One of the things that got Milton Friedman going was Brown v. Board of Education. So how does this compare to that movement?
Very similar, again. So if you go back and you look at the lead up to Brown and the aftermath, you have all these states saying, basically, if there's now a constitutional imperative to integrate, we're going to figure out a way to get kids out from under the reach of the Constitution. And at that point, it was all about race. Well, you know, today it's about trans rights, right? That they are very, very unhappy.
Also race, right?
Also race, exactly, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. But very unhappy about the continual expansion of civil rights. And so if you instead send kids to private schools, even if those private schools are now publicly funded, you're moving them out from under the reach of the Constitution.
We all know the issues that they're obsessing about. You mentioned some of them, the trans kids grooming, drag queen story hour, you know, like, and it's overlapping with the war in libraries too. Same idea. I know there are a lot of religious Christians who are really motivated by those things, but how much of it is that, and how much of that is a front for a broader free market or corporate agenda?
I think it's both. When I go around and I give talks and, you know, I'm trying to help people stay awake, the slide I put up at that point is a strange bedfellows slide where I'll have like a cat sitting on top of a donkey. The coalition is really strange and unwieldy. And so you absolutely have these hardcore libertarians who, you know, are the same libertarians who were around in the 1920s who were repelled by the idea that we were going to consider everyone as being equal. They really have never changed. They just see this as their moment. But then they're very much allied with religious parents. And I think what's really like a rising tide of religiosity, this sense that you have among conservatives, articulated by somebody like Sam Alito on the Supreme Court, that, you know, there was some past where we were godly, and that past is over, and we need to get it back. And they will often refer to, you know, the moment when God was kicked out of the schools. And I think that's why you see these battles playing out on so many fronts at once. And so it's not just school vouchers, it's also sending religious chaplains into the schools in place of counselors. Into public schools, into traditional public schools, taking the opening that's been given by the Supreme Court, this chiseling away of the separation between church and state, and doing everything they can to inject religion into public schools.
Somebody like Christopher Rufo, I admire that guy's skills. He's really good at what he does. How much of an effect does that kind of propaganda have?
It's funny because I would say that he's had mixed success, that for all of his success with critical race theory, and think about just the, you know, tremendous wave of legislation limiting what teachers can talk about and kids can learn. You know, he wasn't able to replicate that success over, say, trans issues, which was going to be his next big terrain. These days, he's talking about K-12 very little. He's moved on almost entirely to higher ed.
He's got his own college to play with.
Exactly. He's got his own college. But I think that where he's successful that we don't pay enough attention to is that he's able to speak to affluent parents, including Democratic parents, who think that equity efforts have really gone too far. They're the parents who are so angry whenever there's something like an attempt to detrack in the schools or get rid of advanced algebra, to make the application process to the elite magnet school more equitable. Like, he understands that those parents are ripe for the picking because they don't want to give up any advantage that their kids have. And the woke progressives don't really understand that.
How much of the COVID closures have an effect? Or is that a fading?
So I think that that is really fading. I think it's really telling that so much of the voucher expansion activity has been in states where schools barely closed, were quick to reopen. And so if the argument that school closures were somehow sort of a fundamental break, that the coalition of people who support public schools shattered as a result of that, I think we would see more of that, both at the policy level, but also, you know, when you look at candidates who've run on that, with the exception of Glenn Youngkin, he really did turn out to be an exception. The candidates in other states who tried to weaponize school closures and then link it to these culture war issues that get continually more extreme, they didn't do well at all.
Well, this stuff isn't really all that popular, right?
No, it's not popular at all. And I think that in the early days, there was a case to be made that something like the protests against, say, mask mandates or mandatory vaccinations, you could point to a coalition of people who were unhappy about those things. But then, you know, like, look at a state like Florida. So mask mandates are banned. And like that, you see the Moms for Liberty candidates pivot to book banning. Book banning is a lot less popular. And so their coalition just got smaller. And we've really seen the same thing play out again and again as they lean into these issues that people don't care about or they think are really extreme. And then I think that public school defenders have gotten much smarter about figuring out how to run against these folks.
I'm speaking with Jennifer Berkshire, co-author of The Education Wars, published by the New Press. This war of the public school system is driven in large part by this narrative that they failed. They're terrible. And there are a couple of things about that that are worth exploring. One is, you know, we've heard this before. You mentioned going back to 1957 or so, Sputnik. The response to that was actually to expand education spending and, you know, to raise higher education and universalize, to some degree, higher ed for everyone. Then we heard it again in the Reagan era, but the reaction was very different. What about this narrative that schools are failing? Where does that come from? What's it based on? Any basis for it?
One thing that doesn't get enough attention right now is that a big reason for our intense fighting over the schools is that we don't agree at all on what they're for. And so as soon as you get into the question of failing, it's like, okay, failing to do what? So for example, over the past three decades, there's been, you know, really kind of remarkable bipartisan agreement that we have schools to prepare kids for college and career, and we're going to measure their success on the basis of things like graduation rates and test scores. But if you look at some of the criticism that's coming from the right now, you know, they're saying this was all a big mistake, that focusing so much on workplace preparation instead of nurturing the souls of kids, we erred with that. They're now talking about schools as failing to get kids into heaven, right? That's really
That's
different.
That's what churches are for.
That's really different from the discourse of No Child Left Behind. And it's interesting that you should mention churches, because they're getting more and more outspoken about the fact that the success of their effort of moving kids into private religious schools will be whether they're able to drive up church attendance.
Are they succeeding? What I've heard is kind of dwindling.
It's early days. At the end of the day, so much of this is really pretty drastic effort to re-engineer kids, right? That they look at the fact that the kids today are socialist, that they favor things like government intervention in all kinds of areas, and they say, this is terrible. What can we do to fix this? Well, let's send kids to private religious schools. Let's teach them lots about free enterprise and that communism is bad. And let's get more religious content into the schools. And that, you know, somehow that's going to make the kids more conservative and more religious. I really have my doubts.
We do expect a lot out of the schools. Democrats have been expecting the schools to do a lot of work of healing social polarization, poverty, growing inequality. The schools really are not capable of doing that. So is that part of the problem, that liberals are expecting too much out of them?
Yeah, that's a huge part of the problem. So think about, you know, the fact that we briefly had this child tax credit that then, you know, evaporated.
That was really nice.
It was really nice.
They sent us free money.
The fact that it succeeded in driving down child poverty by this, you know, enormous figure, and then it's just gone. And it's gone because there isn't the political heft to keep it alive. And instead, it's sort of like, okay, well, we'll go back to the schools. We'll let the schools figure out poverty. It's not possible. I taught in a prison last semester, and many of my students came out of urban school districts where disadvantage is the most concentrated. And it was just like watching their awareness dawn that the schools they attended were being asked to fix and address systemic problems. Like, it was really eye-opening for me.
Well, given the funding formulas, they exacerbate inequality rather than reversing it.
Absolutely, because it isn't just that there isn't enough money to deal with the problems of the kids in front of them. It's that you're looking at generational poverty, and it's so concentrated in these places. What makes that complicated for somebody like me or a public school advocate? It's like, well, okay, you've just raised a big problem with having any connection between school and neighborhood. Why not just abolish that tie, and wouldn't we all be better off?
That's the New York City public school system, yes. But it worked out very well for us, personally. why should people care? I can understand why people with kids in school would care, but why should the general public, those without kids or whose kids have graduated, why should they care?
I think there's a real temptation to view education issues as somehow just separate from our larger politics. But if you look at states where these enormous voucher programs have been rammed through, people who live there will talk about these issues in terms of a broader problem of disenfranchisement. So if you're now like a rural Republican, your party has as part of its defining issue that, you know, that you can't have an elected official who's going to speak up for your local public school. That's what we've been watching play out in Texas, where Greg Abbott and Pennsylvania's wealthiest individual, Jeff Yass,
have been evil.
They've been systematically taking out rural Republicans who support their public schools, right? Because they are absolutely intent on having a voucher program.
Yeah, you noted that this is really hard in rural areas, this kind of movement. Which is absolutely the opposite of what an urban slick like me would think.
Yes, it's terrible because if you're in a rural community, this is your central public institution. It's the largest employer. There aren't really a lot of private schools in these areas. You know, they're not densely populated. Then you're supposed to look at things like, well, online learning, micro schools, tutoring pods. So why we should care about this is that in many ways, this is a divide within the Republican Party, between the Republicans and their own constituents, that we should be able to figure out how to work with. This might be the issue that enables folks to elect people who aren't MAGA extremists.
A lot of the book is about fighting this stuff. Mm-hmm. It's not just an analysis, but also a combat manual. What not to do? What arguments should you not make to start with?
Yeah, so we got a crash course in that during the critical race theory wars. And so people like me, I'm sure you heard this a million times, you know, we would say something like, critical race theory is an academic legal framework typically taught in graduate level courses.
Yes.
And then that made no difference at all, right? We convinced no one about that.
As the kids say, I felt seen.
Yeah, you felt seen. And so we have to overcome our worst impulses to be know-it-alls. And that's really hard if you have anything.
Is it condescending?
It's condescending. And you can go back look at every education war throughout the decades, and it always pits what they refer to disparagingly as the educationists, the know-it-alls, the people who are so convinced by their own knowledge and righteousness, talking down to the little people. And then, you know, that's just fuel to the conflagration. The other point that we try to make in the book that's counterintuitive is that the culture war really isn't something that can be won, right? Like, as satisfying as it might feel to try to vanquish our enemies, as soon as we end up defining schools as belonging to Democrats or belonging to Republicans, we undercut the whole case for them. We see something like, oh, look at this state. They're now encouraging school districts to adapt PragerU. You know, those crazy, crazy videos, Dennis Prager. And so, you know, our response is like, well, we're going to find a progressive counterpart. And we're going to work to get that in the schools.
But it'll be deadly boring and dull.
And also,
that's what the right is good at.
Also, like, the videos would be really long.
I was reminded reading this right after 9/11, during the days of mandatory patriotism, I saw Stanley Fish, a real high dome literary theorist, debating Bill O'Reilly, a real bottom feeding Yahoo, about free expression. And Fish actually crushed O'Reilly. And he did so by appealing to American values and free speech and freedom of choice and all that sort of thing. And Bill O'Reilly was rendered silent. I mean, is that a tip of how to fight this stuff?
Absolutely, especially when you realize how unpopular a lot of these issues are. And I think that's why it's so instructive to look at communities where you've had all these different kinds of groups that haven't traditionally had anything to do with public education banding together to defeat the Moms for Liberty candidates, the 1776 candidates. And it's because they do exactly that, right? They appeal to these larger values. They're basically isolating candidates who are there because they want to ban something. They've got an angry grievance.
And book banning is not popular.
No, it's really unpopular. And it's when you look at the polls and you see how unpopular it is across party lines. The push to ban books typically comes from outside of the communities by people who haven't read the books. And even this is why I think even DeSantis was forced to water down some of the book banning policies there, because it was getting really embarrassing.
Now, you close the book with a call to reclaim education as a public good. What do you mean by that? How do you do that?
That's a huge problem, is that, you know, like over the past few decades, we define K-12 more and more like we do higher ed. This is an investment in your individual human capital. If you want to invest more, you move where the good schools are, right? You fight to get into that elite magnet school. We don't encourage people at all to think about other people's kids. And so all the voucher stuff doing is just making that more extreme. It's just saying, here, we're going to fund students, not systems, which is kind of like saying, we're going to fund cars, not highways. We're going to fund individual commuters. I don't think anyone would look at our higher ed system and think, this is great. What a model, right? You take on all this debt. Hopefully, you'll make wise decisions, and that'll pay off for you in the long run, right? It's a crazy way to run an education system. Unless we're able to think about K-12 as a public good that benefits more than the individual education consumers, and I'm using little air quotes, that's exactly the direction that we're headed in.
That was Jennifer Berkshire, co-author along with Jack Schneider of The Education Wars, a citizen's guide and defense manual from the New Press. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of a 1988 classic from The Godfathers, Birth, School, Work, Death. Till next week, bye.
Upside down, but all at sea until I've drowned. And I've put torture off, no pain, just like that film of Michael Caine. I've been abused, I've been confused, and I've kissed my reflexes, you.